Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. On today's program, we discuss youth journalism and the future of the Fourth Estate. We will be joined by Louis LaVenture. Please stay with us.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III and Desiree McSwain. We are broadcasting from lovely Hayward, California at the California State University East Bay campus. And as always, I'm excited to be here with my colleagues. Special announcer Amy, why don't you tell us who's going to be on the show?
Greetings, listeners. I am Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. Today's guest is Louis LaVenture, the current editor-in-chief at the Pioneer newspaper. He will be discussing youth journalism. But before we get to Louis, I would like to remind you that you can go to projectcensored.org/podcast to catch this show and previous shows, as well as any other podcast that might interest you. We also would like to hear your feedback on our show. You can send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. And now you can contact us on Twitter. We have Nolan Higdon and Dr. Baham III. Nolan can be reached @Nolan_Higdon. And Nick can be reached @DrDreadlocks. And the spelling is DocTorDreDlocks.
All right. Thank you, Amy. Looking forward to the tweets. We can communicate like a president, Nick. It's going
to
be great.
Fantastic. Commit to doing it at 2 in the morning on the toilet.
That's the most responsible thing to do.
I think so.
We did get listener feedback. We didn't get it via email. We got a ton of voicemails, and particularly about Manar Mahalish of Mint Press being on our show. Again, I would encourage listeners to contact us directly via Twitter, email. That's the best way. But there were some issues people had with Mint Press News being on our podcast. And I'll just remind our listeners that the interview was with Manar. If you don't like some of the things she does at Mint Press, you don't have to read Mint Press. I happen to like Mint Press and like Manar and like having her on the show. We just enjoyed having her, and we're happy she was on the show. And speaking of the show, we want to bring more of the show to you. We need your support. And if you can go to projectcensored.org/radio, you can support the Project Censored Show. And early September, we're going to have a bonus show for you guys available online at the Project Censored website. Nick is going to develop his show about film and authoritarianism. You want to tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, so what we're going to be doing in the future is I've got a list of my top five political films that deal with the rise of authoritarianism in America, that critique it, and that also critique both the corporate state as well our media, frankly. And so we're going to be presenting those with some excerpts and giving a critique of them and hopefully introducing the listeners to some new films that they haven't seen.
And sure, if you want to get a list of those films, join us on Twitter, join us on projectcensored.org. We'll release the list, give you plenty of time to watch them so you can tune in and participate in the conversation. You know, speaking of sort of media and this authoritarianism, you know, we've been hearing consistently since the 2016 election that the media was going to have this come-to-Jesus moment and start reporting on facts again and inform the public and become responsible journalists all over again. And in fact, Huffington Post is doing a 23-city tour to hear concerns across the nation. And their reason for doing this is, quote, to rebuild trust in media, which has bottomed out. But I noticed that a lot of these, it's critical to note that a lot of these media infrastructure or a lot of these media outlets don't have the infrastructure to actually report on the news. They've been cutting back journalists since the 1970s. And we saw more evidence of this week. Pulitzer Prize winner James Risen is now leaving the New York Times. We found that out this week. And for our listeners, Risen was the one who was behind giving us the evidence to contend that the Bush administration was lying about weapons of mass destruction. He also was the one who started getting on the trail that the NSA was secretly spying on U.S. citizens. He's twice faced jail time for not giving up CIA contacts. So Risen has quite a good history as a journalist, but he's another one of these guys who has a long career that's now being cut, I would argue, short. And so I kind of wonder how they're going to rebuild trust in media. And in particular, I thought this was interesting with all the discussions about election fraud and Russia hacking the elections. And before we get into the media, I want to note something kind of interesting on this. If you haven't been paying attention, the corporate media has been banging the drum that Hillary Clinton lost this election because of Russian tampering with the Trump administration. And we'll get to that in a minute. But what I think is interesting is that the corporate media only now cares about election hacking or election fraud. This is something we at The Project have been covering for the last few decades. We covered it in Mexico. We covered it in the 08 election, the 2004 election, 2016 election. We've covered it with the death of people who were in charge of election fraud. And it's been covered widespread at projectcensored.org. But now the media seems to care about this issue. And I don't know, I'd be interested to hear your views on this, Nick and Desiree. I think that, like, in my opinion, I see, like, the two camps of elites complaining against each other. They're having a fight and asking us to take sides. On the one hand, I see Trump and the Republicans and the Russians colluding together to win the White House. On the other side, I see the Democratic Party colluding at the expense of the Bernie Sanders movement to fix the nomination process and win the White House, because that's the key component, right? They're saying Russia hacked these emails. Well, it's important to remember the content of the emails, which also show the Democrats were trying to fix the election on their end as well. So we have these kind of two elite parties that are asking us to choose sides. I kind of wonder what your take was on that.
Well, first of all, we don't have free and fair elections anymore, and that's my take on it. One of the things that I was struck by this week that was also not covered by the news media was that a Kenyan official was murdered for introducing biometric systems into their voting. And this is apparently an electronic system that helps to determine that the person who says that they're voting is actually the person who is voting using some sort of biometric technology. It's apparently going to be a close election in Kenya, and that's why this individual was murdered. My question is, why don't we have this kind of technology in the United States? Why aren't we talking about this kind of technology in the United States? Why aren't we having a legitimate conversation in our media about whether our elections really are fair? And by that, I'm not referring to the conspiracy theories that have come down from 45. That's also a part of this shadow game, right? That there are a bunch of people who are not citizens who are voting illegally. That's not the case. I think what is a bigger part are people who are being struck off of voting rolls. And there's a concerted campaign at the federal level to gain access to voter rolls in every one of our states in order to be able to continue this practice. Because you don't have free and fair elections, and because these practices are particularly targeted towards poor people and people of color, in fact, what you have is you have the beginnings of an electoral apartheid. We are not having critical discussions about this in the media.
And I think it's important you brought up about the media as well. There's currently claims made in a recent lawsuit that the Trump administration and the Republican Party actually worked with Fox News for this fake story about how there was a Democratic Party member who released those emails from Hillary Clinton, and that person ended up getting killed. And so it couldn't have been the Russians. The story was released back in May, and it's sort of fallen off the radar. Fox News ended up retracting after a week, but Sean Hannity kept reporting on it.
I'm sure he's still reporting on it on his radio.
Oh, I have
no doubt. It's painful to listen to his radio program.
But in a recent court case, now the defendants of this are saying that actually Fox News worked with the White House to fabricate that story. And so you talked about how we don't have a real serious conversation with election fraud. I feel like election fraud has been really a victim of news abuse. It's brought up when it serves the people in power, and it's ignored when it does not. So they'll have no qualms about talking about how Saddam Hussein rigged elections or Maduro in Venezuela and these types of events. But here in the U.S., it's never talked about unless it serves a one party against the other party.
That's correct. Your news media is not free in the sense that, so if Fox colluded with the Trump administration, this is a classic example of a sort of blend between what should be a free and independent media. And we, of course, we know that Fox is not anything like free and independent, but it should be free and independent of both government and from capitalism, from market forces. First of all, the media, as I've, you know, I've said before on this program, the news should not make money. Period. And that, I think, is a fundamental problem in this country, when news entered into a field of having to make money instead of being the thing that you knew when you ran your network that you were going to lose money on, but it was a valuable public service. It's not a public service anymore. Unless you're listening to listener-supported public radio, you're not getting a public service, and you're not really getting real news.
Prior to the show, me and Nick, we were talking about Chris Hedges. He wrote that book, Empire of Illusion. And in it, Hedges talked about how the fall of societies like the Roman Empire and others had resulted after the people had become sort of mystical and distracted from real events. And this had undermined democracy, which in turn undermined the empire. And remember, we were talking about, you made an interesting connection to what was going on in the Scaramucci case with this.
Yeah, so I was listening. I've spent a little bit of time listening to Chris. In particular, I spent some time listening to Greg Bridges' show, where he featured a great deal of Hedges' comments. And I was struck by Hedges' comparison of the fall of the Roman Empire, in particular the Roman Emperor Commodus, to Trump. And this kind of show that you had both with Commodus and with Trump of this kind of sort of idiocracy, of people who had bottomless egos, bottomless narcissism. Commodus in particular staged gladiator fights. He liked to fancy himself a gladiator, so he obviously staged contests in which he could win. But while that was all of this was going on, both in Rome and I think what Hedges is saying in the United States is that while this show is going on, firing Scaramucci, getting rid of Ranks Priebus, the whole circus, there are other things that are happening where state power, the deep state, is coalescing. We're not talking about what we're doing with respect to having a critical discussion about North Korea right now, for example. We're having actually a very ahistorical discussion about North Korea. And then the other piece is that we're not talking about the sort of continued consolidation of moneyed power in this country. And the fact that we frankly have lost, according to Hedges, we have really lost our democratic rights in this country because of the confluence of military power and the capitalist oligarch power in this country. Hedges is trying to draw our attention to some of these things that we, I think, have been distracted by. And the news media is not doing a good job of helping us to stay focused. So, for example, while the Scaramucci scandal was going on, or whatever you want to call that, those horrible 11 days of his tenure as White House communications director, there was some very interesting testimony before a Senate Judiciary Committee by William Browder, Bill Browder, a businessman who did a lot of business in Russia with a lawyer by the name of Sergei Magnitsky. And they uncovered millions of dollars that were being appropriated through thuggery, et cetera, and how the Russian system of government kind of operates on blackmail, torture, murder to seize assets, all of which have helped to make Vladimir Putin one of the richest men in the country. So there is a law or an act called the Magnitsky Act. Magnitsky, by the way, was killed for his efforts for trying to report this to Russian authorities, thinking that he could reach out to good people in Russia. So this Magnitsky Act freezes assets that are held in the West from the ill-gotten gains of this behavior. Now, it turns out that Vladimir Putin has assets in the West that come from this ill-gotten gain. So technically, his assets, according to Bill Browder's testimony, fall under the Magnitsky Act. Now, your big question here is not only will Donald Trump sign the sanctions passed by Congress against Russia, But will he enforce the Magnitsky Act with respect to Putin? Our eyes were totally off that while we were following the circus.
I think your point's well founded. The media's job here is to keep people on track, to pay attention to these important issues, not report on the distractions, but keep our attention away from the distractions. And I mean, I always remind students of this constantly, that the press is the only job that's constitutionally protected. We have a constitutional right to have this job exist. So with that, we're going to take a short musical break. When we come back, we're going to talk to our guest, Louis LaVenture, who's going to talk to us about youth journalism, how the youth see the media, and what are some new trends in journalism. Stay with us. We'll be back after the short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. We spent the beginning of the show talking about sort of the dismal state of media, and we at Project Censored have always been a very student-focused organization focused on journalism and the youth, and it's our pleasure to bring in Louis LaVenture as our guest. Louis LaVenture studied English and Ethnic Studies here at California State University East Bay. He also holds an associate's degree in human development. Louis is the former editor-in-chief of the Ohlone College newspaper, The Monitor, and is the current editor-in-chief of The Pioneer in Hayward, California. Both publications have received numerous national recognition awards from several publication organizations, including College Media Association and the Journalism Association of Community Colleges. Louis, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be here, finally.
So, Louis, tell our listeners a little bit about sort of how you kind of see the mood of the youth journalists. Like, how are young people reacting to the opportunity to take part in journalism? Is it an exciting time, in your opinion? What do you think?
Initially, when I started in this journalism thing for college students, there wasn't much of an atmosphere and environment that promoted student involvement. It was kind of, I just happen to want to be in this field, so let me get to it. The Trump bump is definitely something that has increased participation a lot more. We actually do a Trump Tracker weekly, and it's kind of just generated more interest in journalism because there's so much stuff to cover now.
Okay, so you do see a link, you think, between sort of the rise of Trump's nomination and election and journalism amongst the youth?
Definitely. Compared to when I first started about 4 years ago to now, there's just so much stuff to talk about, and the Trump thing is just really interesting to the youth and students. People want to talk about it. They want to expose what's going on. I guess there's not a lot of people on his side in my age bracket, but they're still very interested, and there's a lot more interest than there was just as recently as 4 years ago.
Well, talk to me a little more about that. That's something I'm particularly interested in. We talk about age brackets and conceptions of journalism. There seems to be, in my opinion, a much different conception of what journalism is or supposed to do amongst youth as compared to older generation. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. We get a lot of pushback from older journalists and older viewers and readers of our website and our publication. A lot of people in an older age bracket prefer hardcore reporting, where you're on the streets, you're talking to people, you have a lot of sources, and youth, especially youth journalists, younger journalists, tend to be more flexible with that idea. We could do featurey stuff. We can still talk about Trump in a featurey way. We can highlight individual aspects of things. It doesn't have to be hardcore reporting.
First, thanks for being on the show. That's exciting. But I wanted to ask, how do you guys at the paper straddle giving Trump maybe too much exposure or following stories that other people are following and not wanting to necessarily give him an extra light versus informing and kind of updating the youth, because otherwise that might be the only outlet that they might see some of the Trump stuff through. So how do you straddle that?
Definitely. We try not to just cover what everybody's covering. A lot of times people, especially student papers, will go to the New York Times and see what they're covering and mimic what they cover. What we try to do is we try to dig a little deeper and find things that connect to East Bay, find things that connect to students particularly, and things that are interesting to our community. So just because 100 organizations are covering one thing that Trump's doing doesn't mean we're going to do that too. We're looking for a different angle. We're always looking for something more interesting to tie back to East Bay, to tie back to students. So it's tough though, because everything he does seems newsy, seems important, seems like a sideshow, but it's up to us to kind of figure out what's best for us as an East Bay student-driven publication. Mm-hmm.
As a professor, and as a professor who's had the pleasure of having you in the classroom, one of the things I've noticed is that young people are very interested in ushering in sort of a new era of social protest. And yet, I think it's very clear that when we historicize social protest, especially from the 60s, we see that one of the fatal flaws that we've made as a society is that we allowed social protesters, in particular African-American, Black, Brown, and API social movements, and LGBTQ social movements to be demonized. In the 60s, we allowed those people to be killed, and some of them had to flee the country, and some of them were jailed. And we let that happen, and maybe that's a portion of, like, why we've lost some of the democratic rights that we've lost up to this point. How do young people who are cognizant of that, who have learned about that and have learned to think critically through that period, how do they reconceive of themselves as, for lack of a better expression, as the new militants?
That's a good question. I believe that in order to progress, you have to acknowledge the history. So it's important to see those techniques that were used in the 60s and 70s and apply them in a way that are meaningful today. So you're not exactly allowed to be militant in a protest. You're going to get shut down by some type of force, police, security, whatever it is. But it's about getting your message across, and being nonviolent is the best approach. Mm-hmm. Gathering, taking things that you've learned from those previous generations that were successful, like the civil rights movement, and applying them in a new way. I wouldn't go to a protest and just have signs with profanity. That's a whole different style. My style would be to be peaceful. I would encourage, let's keep focus on the issues. Let's not turn it into a riot. A lot of people my age like to just go out and cause chaos. They like the chaos. Mm-hmm. I've been a part of a couple of protests, Occupy Oakland, another one here in Hayward when Trump was elected. And things could have got out of hand, but they had solid leadership who was promoting, let's stick to the issues, let's promote why we're here, let's let them know why we don't agree with this. And I think that's more important than just showing force. A lot of people just want to show, look how deep we are, look how many people we have here, and it could be a little intimidating. Mm-hmm. So it's hard, it's a tough question, but I just believe you got to maintain a nonviolent, non-aggressive approach and stick to your issues, stick to your guns.
Desiree, weren't you were mentioning the same topic before as well, with the kind of the careful balance of all these social protests, right?
Yeah, and I was also at Occupy and Justice for Trayvon and a lot of movements like that, specifically in Oakland, but also in the city, Justice for Mario Woods and Alex Nieto. And it's really hard to not only just control a crowd, but control a demographic of people, the youth, my age, 24, 20s, that kind of age, where we have so much angst. And this is almost, a lot of people are viewing this as their first time being able to uprise, and they may view this presidency as the first presidency where they really feel like they've felt some injustice or some oppression. And that could be lack of not knowing the history, but it goes along with wanting to lash out against the system and not do it in an organized way. And mobilization or protest, you know, that's a step, but that's really the least effective step. But that's the first step that we go to, I think, as youth, because that's really all we're shown in movies. What we talk about the protests and the marches. We don't talk about the committees and the subcommittees, the working groups, and the organizations. It's really hard to gain an understanding, but also kind of gain control of that movement when we're moving so fast. We have social media, so all you see is a posting of something going on tonight, and you're there before you can even think about it. You don't know who's leading it. It could be led by the police, for all we know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's lack of critical thinking in that.
Yeah, and I think that, I guess my question for both Desiree and Lois, really, to carry on the conversation, is it seems to me that the critique, the theory and the practice have to be sharper than they ever were before, sharper than they had to be in the 60s. You have to have read more, for example, okay? You have to think a lot deeper, right, into everything. You know, I was thinking today before I came into the broadcast about the stuff that we don't talk about with respect to Adam Smith, for example, how we conceive of capitalism. Smith also wrote about moral values that needed to undergird capitalism, and wrote extensively about what could happen to the worker, how the worker could be turned into a machine and debased and be devalued. No one talks about that. No one thinks at that depth about the kind of capitalism, that, for example, that we've created, that has turned us into the machines that we've been turned into, and that has turned a lot of our population, frankly, into disposable individuals. For example, disposable individuals within the context of the criminal justice system, which is a business in this country. So it seems like to me that young activists have to read more than what I read when I was in the 20s, and at a deeper level.
Yeah, I think you also have to do a lot of what we don't want to do. And that's kind of what I was hinting at, is organizing and strategizing. That's not the glamorous thing. People don't want to do that. They want to throw Molotovs at the police station and stuff like that, which is one way to do it and one way to create anarchy, if that's what, if you're an anarchist, which we have a group of those in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. But that's not solution based. And so what are we going to have, a burning, you know, society at the end of all that? There's no critical thought there.
Yeah, I would concur on that too. And I think part of that reading, and as well as you're talking about methodology, Desiree, is developing empathy as a key component of that. So this moral development is part of that learning process to be able to empathize with others. You're listening to the Project Censored show, and we are talking to Lois LaVenture. Lois is the editor-in-chief of the Pioneer newspaper, and we are talking to him about youth journalism. Lois, how is it as an editor-in-chief? I mean, many people probably don't know this, but you have a really difficult job. You manage a lot of personalities. You manage the faculty, the campus, the economics of the paper, the students, the contributors, the website, et cetera, et cetera. How do you sort of manage that to keep this commitment you seem to have to making sure you have a diverse paper and that you're going to speak truth and power while also keeping that journalistic integrity? How do you manage all of that?
It's really difficult. There's a lot of pushback from every angle. A lot of the times the school doesn't like what we write about, but I have to be bigger and better than that. I have to do what's right for our paper. So we've established that we're trying to serve the East Bay, cover things all East Bay, and cover things ideally that people aren't talking about, because when something's reported on heavily by the media, we kind of view it as overkill, or like Nicholas said, a distraction. It's trying to distract from what's really happening. We're trying to dig deeper in our story pitches and our ideas and our relationships with the campus for things that are flying under the radar and things that we should be talking about. And this tends to lead to really more ethnically diverse issues than a lot of the regular media talk about. That's kind of been my goal, is to just expose other things that people aren't talking about. And it's really hard because we don't get a lot of sources. We're a small publication. It's hard to get quality, reputable sources on the record, but it's something I constantly try to do, constantly try to have our writers and editors do always looking to pitch something more interesting or that nobody's talking about.
Could you speak to us a little bit about sort of the philosophy you have? Because here in Hayward, California, is close to San Francisco. You could take the and Berkeley, you could take the low-hanging fruit and cover everything, UC Berkeley and Golden Gate Bridge and Silicon Valley, and probably up your readership. But you have a commitment to staying local. You really believe in the staying local concept. Can you explain a little bit of why that is, you have that commitment?
Since 1961, the Pioneer has been an East Bay exclusive community-driven paper, and that's what's kept up the viewership and the readership is covering the East Bay. So we have kind of like a mantra of don't go over the bridges. Stay in the East Bay, don't go to San Mateo, don't go to San Francisco, unless it really calls for it or it's a national story that's happening. I mean, it's just a commitment that was here before me. I'm just trying to usher it on and keep it going. And being from Hayward, from right down the street, it's easier for me because I know what's real and what's fake. I can tell when somebody's trying to push me a story. I know about all these programs. I grew up in the neighborhood. I know about what they're doing. It's a little easier for me to filter through that stuff, but it would be hard for somebody who wasn't from the area to keep it tight. So there have been times where editor-in-chiefs have lapsed in judgment. We cover the city. We cover Burlingame. Ideally, stuff we don't want to do, but me being so local, it helps with that.
Yeah, I think I'm personally a big believer in the covering things locally. I think sometimes we get in, this might go back to what we were talking about earlier about empathy and Nick and Desiree were talking about movements and social movements. It almost kind of seems like a reality show on the national level a lot. You can have these debates it's kind of like almost debate sports or something it feels like you don't have control over, but those same events happen in your community and they become real all of a sudden. They're real and you're having real conversations and usually more solutions based. I think that's why the local press is so important. And as we've seen that gutted over the years, you have less, people know less about their locality, and that's why you're able to have a lot of the problems we have.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, there's too much for me on the national media that's about, let me push my book, let me push my celebrity, let me come out with an outrageous opinion so you get on my Twitter feed, yada, yada, yada. Let's go to commercial and make some money off of this thing. We talked on a previous program about the disaster that is Morning Joe and the whole Mika and Joe Scarborough fiasco. It's bread and circuses, man. And I really respect what you're doing here. It's like what Gray Slick sang for the Jefferson Airplane. Feed your head, right? But you really mean that. Right? We're not talking LSD. You really mean that. Read, understand something about your community and understand something about the social forces in your community. And the fact that you're so focused on the East Bay is compelling to me because we're in the middle of, probably close to the end of, really dramatic gentrification in the East Bay that is the result of a lot of not only market forces, but also of predatory policing and of policies that have been in effect since the 1960s to squash militant movements, so-called militant movements in the Bay Area. In particular, I've always felt like Oakland was punished. It has long been punished. That era following the 60s, Oakland was flooded in crack. And then it was flooded with policing. And what is the end result of that? Is the devaluation of property and allowing the corporate state to come on in and acquire property and move people out like they're chess pieces. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Robert Self wrote that great book, American Babylon. I'd recommend to our listeners, covering a lot of things Dr. Bam's talking about there. So we're talking to Louis LaVenture. We're going to take a short musical break. When we get back, we're going to talk about why he became a journalist, his advice to young journalists, where he sees the field of journalism going. A lot to cover. We'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bam III and Desiree McSwain. And we are talking to Louis LaVenture, the editor-in-chief of the Pioneer newspaper in Hayward, California. Louis, before we took a break, I was interested in sort of noting, what drove you to get into the field of journalism or become interested in journalism in the first place?
So I grew up right down the street from here on a street called Gadding Road, which is notoriously known as one of the toughest streets in Hayward. And I grew up around a lot of death, a lot of shooting, a lot of just poverty. And I saw how the Daily Review, the former paper of Hayward, now the East Bay Times, covered our neighborhood, and I hated it. Never reported on violent crimes. Their reporting was always lacking. It was never talking to sources. It was just always a press release. And that's what drove me. I lost a couple of uncles who were gang members, and I saw how their deaths were covered in the paper, and it drove me to get in this industry and try to put my spin on it, try to get somebody actually from here to get into these publications and show you what's really going on, that it's not like this all the time, that sometimes people are a victim of circumstance and their geography, and it's something that doesn't get talked about enough to me. The Oscar Grant killing by the BART police officer, Johannes Messerli, he was a friend of one of my cousins and related to me by marriage a little bit. So that kind of upped the ante a little bit too. I was just disenfranchised with the way it was covered and the way they played him out. And it kind of drove me to just get involved.
Yeah, Louis, can you speak a little bit more about like how you as a journalist cover the phenomena of gang violence? We now have a chief executive who has spoken openly to police in Long Island about being a little bit more violent, with especially with Latinos who he associates with gang violence. He's sort of now conflated that, right?
Definitely.
Latino, Latinx with gang, with quote-unquote illegal, right?
Yes.
That ugly term. How do you cover this with any depth to give us a sense, and the reader a sense, of the social forces that drive, that are really behind quote-unquote gang violence?
So I have a little bit more of an in this area, and I've covered several stories about gangs and violence in Hayward because I am from the neighborhood and I am a former gang member, and I probably will always be considered part of the crew from the neighborhood. So I have a little bit more of a connection with them that most reporters do. I can actually walk in these neighborhoods and go in people's houses and eat and talk to them and find out what's going on. Not every reporter can do that. So I have a unique relationship with the local Hayward neighborhoods to where they will talk to me sometimes, and I've done it before. I've got gang members on record, and it's not something easy to do, and I feel like you have to be a part of the community to do that. So it's hard because I have to find this balance between putting not shining a bad light and telling the truth, and it's really tough, but I feel like my history and my involvement in the neighborhood allows me to find comfort with these people, and they just want to tell me what's really going on. They want people to know what's really going on in these neighborhoods, and mm-hmm. It's tough because there's not a lot to do. So a lot of them find that comfort in gangs and street gangs, which is crazy. And for Trump to make that comment about don't be so easy on them, and he plagiarized the Seinfeld joke about rough them up, rough them up, rough them up, and then, when you put them in the car, watch their head.
Yeah.
I think Nolan and I talked about it. The cops clapping behind him when he said it was cringeworthy, and it's just sad because unless you're involved in the community and you know what they're going through, you don't know, and so you can't cover it accurately.
And at the same time, he also celebrated local police forces gaining access to military surplus weapons.
Yes, I can't even fathom that this is real. It just doesn't seem real. It seems that seems like fake news that our president would be doing, talking about stuff like that.
Well, it's always been done, right? But it's now out in the open. Right?
And he's using this MS-13 as a crutch to do it because people are scared of MS-13. This is a gang that's recently reached the Bay Area, and having a few interactions with some MS-13 members, they are really scary. And the ones I've interacted with don't value life. They will kill to protect their stuff, their MS-13. And the couple that I've had interactions with in Oakland, I believe that it's just not, you can't just talk about it. You have to be involved. You have to get in the community and actually know these people. And who's going to let Donald Trump into a gang meeting? Probably nobody.
Can I ask you, what are the social forces that create an MS-13?
Well, the first thing is just a need for belonging to something bigger. People who are speaking from personal experience, people who don't have a lot, who are raised by, you know, drug addicts or raised by their grandparents because their parents couldn't raise them, they're looking to belong to something. And that's what I was looking for. I needed something bigger. And all I knew was street violence type of stuff. And so that's what I went for. I can't speak for them necessarily, but I'm assuming that's the main thing, wanting to belong to something bigger and be a part of a force, regardless of how violent it is.
I think, in Lewis's comments, it reminded me of the book by Lowry, was They Can't Kill Us All. And he talked about how he's a journalist for the Washington Post, and he went to each one of these, not each one, many protests from Black Lives Matter after these police killings. And he sort of concluded that each local area's protests were about local issues. It wasn't just about the one shooting and that's what they were focused on. They each had their own set of local issues. And I think your discussion there fits in perfect, right? That Hayward has its own local issues. And that's the importance of having local journalism, someone who can speak to those issues. Because what Lowry also showed, and I'm sure you saw this as a youth, as you talked about, and we see this nationally, is these outsiders coming in for like 2 weeks. Right. So there's a killing of like Oscar Grant. Okay, we'll come in from New York. We'll stay in San Francisco. We'll come over here in the morning, talk to one or two local people, and then go back to the city and send off our publication. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's reporters coming from the outside who really don't know the community and the local needs and demands. So with that in mind and given your experience, what's sort of your advice to young people who may want to get into journalism or who are maybe approaching the field or considering a degree in it? What would be kind of be your advice to those folks?
I was actually told when I started in journalism not to major in it, that it's a dying breed. That I was advised by an advisor not to do this. And I looked at her like she was crazy because this is the only thing I wanted to do. So I was a little confused. She told me to keep my options broad and major in English, which is what I did, and we didn't have a journalism program here, so it kind of set me back. However, if they do have a journalism program at a school, I encourage everybody to attend it who wants to be a journalist, because you need to learn all these things. You need to learn how to report, how to talk to people, how to do the interview, how to find great stories. You need to learn all these things, and you don't learn them in programs that aren't through journalism. So my advice would be to find a school that offers a program of journalism, probably, and hopefully they'll have a good structure there to teach them the right way to report. I feel like a lot of these schools out here do that, and that's probably the key. Not me majoring in English wasn't necessarily the best thing for my journalism career. I didn't learn much in the English department about journalism, so ideally that would be my best advice: find a school that offers a program or a major.
There's a bunch of English teachers right now who are driving off the road.
Sorry, Jacqueline Doyle. I apologize.
Lewis, I had the same experience. I was driven away from majoring in journalism by family, by faculty. And I think it's interesting that we both, as Black and brown youth from the Bay Area, from such a soil, fertile ground for any kind of protest or any kind of political sense, are driven away from really telling our own stories and being the street reporters and being the ones who can actually report to that by a larger body of people who maybe want us to assimilate or don't think that we can, want us to report in an assimilated way. So it's funny that we're driven away from that, but you can't, because in this day and age, we're going to go and report it on our Twitter or our Instagram a personal way. It may just be a picture of what's going on and a little caption, but that's still reporting, and that's on the ground, firsthand experience. And then again, we've experienced the poverty and experienced the gentrification, the racism, and the oppression within our own land. So we can only understand that even more on a grander level. It's really important, and I commend you for doing what you're doing and for continuing to push through that, because journalism is a hard field and it's dominated by people who are not like us. So we're going to constantly be able to go up against that, but you have to be strong. And I think that you definitely show that and you exemplify that.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So, not easy.
So Lewis, and also for Desiree, how do you sustain yourself as a grounded, community-based, fact-based journalist a youth journalist in today's world? How do you sustain yourself? Because unfortunately, we still live within the context of a capitalist society. So how do you keep the thing going?
It's really hard. It gets really frustrating. I hit a lot of walls trying to report the way I want to report. A lot of people don't like to talk to me about things I'm trying to cover. I've been chasing a handful of stories for 6-7 months now because they're so hard to get sources for. So what I do is I try to stay true to myself. I try to use my community connections, my growing up in the area, knowing a lot of people, to gain the trust. I feel like that's the only way people really open up and talk to you, is if they trust you. I've been primarily focused on Hayward, Oakland, San Leandro, the strictly East Bay, trying to bring some trust back to journalism, I guess, since a lot of people are saying they don't trust the media anymore. I feel like the only way is to talk about things I know, talk about things that I am very passionate about. That way it shows to the people I'm interviewing and it shows to the people whose stories I'm covering. And I just feel like it breeds better journalism that way for me.
Yeah, I kind of do the same thing, just focus on local, focus on issues that affect me and that will continue to affect my community and not try to get weighed down by so much going on because I see like 100 stories a day that can really tear me down, that can frighten me almost in a way. And then also the backlash that you may get from other people that you're seemingly fighting for just because of the nature of how we're brought up. People like to go against truth tellers or truth spitters or whatever you want to call them. But I think really just keeping grounded, remembering why you're doing this, because at the end of the day, when I look at these people in my community, I see myself and I hear myself. I can't go out and fight for Trayvon Martin if I don't fight for Oscar Grant here. That's what I try to keep in mind.
Where do you, Lewis, where do you see the field going? Kind of, what's your personal plan for the future and where do you see the field going from here of journalism?
It's pretty clear that the youth get their stuff from their phone. I mean, it's 95%, and that's not a real stat. I'm just in my head. It's 95% people looking at their mobile phone and getting their news. So ideally, I believe everything should be going toward multimedia, toward mobile, creating these journalistic packages of a short video, audio from where you're reporting, pictures to accompany your story. It's bigger than people just picking up a piece of paper and reading it. It doesn't work like that anymore, especially for the youth. Some people on campus don't even know we have a newspaper, but they do know we have a website and they're on our site and they do know we have a Facebook, a Twitter, Instagram. It's about moving to that generation to accommodate multimedia stuff, and that seems to be to pull in youth, especially for readership. That's where I'm trying to go, create multimedia pieces for everything I do.
You going to keep pursuing this field?
Definitely. I'm looking at grad school right now. I have a couple. I got accepted to one, and I'm going to apply to a couple more. So I'm definitely going to pursue a graduate degree in journalism and try to keep going in the field.
What if people want to get a hold of you? How can they get a hold of you?
Get me on Twitter. That's probably the best way. It's my name, Lewis LaVenture 1, and I'm on Twitter all day. That's probably the best way to get at me.
Spell it out for them.
LouisLaVenture 1, and find me on Twitter.
Desiree, when are you going to get a Twitter account?
Soon,
you don't have a Twitter account?
No,
today.
I don't.
We're going to sign you up now.
Yeah, I'm forced tonight.
the listeners want to get a hold of you, Desiree. On a Twitter account. This is a good opportunity, though. Maybe we should have just like some sort of contest to come up with the best Twitter name for Desiree.
Yeah, I was going
right.
to say that.
Right. I was thinking about
that. Would be
that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
You could actually do a poll on Twitter, which would be really
oh,
cool.
Oh, right.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah. Yeah. So send us your poll names for a possible Desiree McSwain Twitter handle.
It should be really interesting, the responses.
Yeah.
All right. He's Lewis LaVenture. He is the editor-in-chief of The Pioneer in Hayward, California. He's a phenomenal guest and a great individual. And Lewis, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll be back after this short musical break.
I'm not afraid.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with Dr. Nicholas Bayham III and Desiree McSwain. We here at the Media Freedom Foundation produce content that illuminates the work of fact-based journalists around the world and offers alternative narratives to the corporate press. Amy is here to tell us more.
This is Amy Casey of the Media Freedom Foundation with some highlights of student-generated content featuring journalism themes. At the Global Critical Media Literacies webpage, gcml.org, Dr. Rob Williams and his student, Kelly Dugan, from the University of Vermont, have published BuzzFeed Equals Junk Food. Are social media platforms ruining journalism? The article postulates the correlation between shortened attention spans of news consumers and the quality of information from increasingly popular mediums of tweets, short videos, and lists. Journalism is the product of years of schooling and impeccable writing skills, yet the news seems to be shifting from well-written pieces to oversimplified shareable content. Also at gcml.org, 21st Century Media Monopoly. This story, written by Dr. Nolan Higdon and his student, Michelle Halpin, at Diablo Valley College, observed the news abuse committed regarding the restoration of an FCC rule called the UHF discount and the subsequent purchase of Tribune Media by Sinclair Broadcasting Group. The rule change and purchase indicate the consolidation of big media that continues to close the gap toward full media monopoly by eliminating both competition and criticism. From the University of Regina, Patricia Elliott and her student, Corey Coleman, have nominated a validated independent news story, that is, a story ignored by the corporate press but covered by the independent press, titled Slovenian Journalism Student Exposes Government Official. The story examines the importance of journalism after a university student and junior correspondent in Slovenia exposed an underqualified government official during an interview at a public hearing, which resulted in the politician's dismissal. That can be found at projectcensored.org. In another validated independent news story, also from the University of Regina, Patricia Elliott and her student, Katie Doke-Swawatsky, published Seattle Activist Group Leads First Successful Campaign to Defund Police. The story looks at the successful and unprecedented Block the Bunker campaign in Seattle, which persuaded city officials to divest public funding and allocate more funding for community services. That is also available at projectcensored.org. From the University of Vermont, Dr. Rob Williams and his student, Kelsey Sparrow, published a validated independent news story titled Voluntourism Exposed: What Americans Don't Know About New Social Impact Vacation Cruises. The article observes the altruistic intentions of voluntourism, also called socially responsible tourism, but notes the underlying problems such as the exploitation of children, which pose threats to the economy and well-being of the community members in the host countries. That can be found at projectcensored.org. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to projectcensored.org/podcast. There you can access free content and show your support for Project Censored. We would also like to hear your feedback. Any questions, comments, concerns, you can send those to our email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Now, Nick and Nolan have also joined the Twitter realm. You can find Nolan at Nolan_Higdon, or you can find Nick at Dr. Dreadlocks, that is DocTorDreDlocks. I am Amy Casey, and that is the news that did not make the news.
Thank you, Amy. So, Desiree, you've had about 3 minutes to think about it. Did you come up with a Twitter name yet?
Not at all. Now I feel so pressured. I mean, hearing Nick's, I don't know how I'm going to follow that.
Nick does everything like really cool. It's unfair. A certain level.
Yeah, you know, some of us just have it like that. Right?
Yeah, apparently.
But I really am interested in sort of a listener contest.
I think that'll be kind of fun because I also don't, not that I don't care, but I'm not going to make a big emphasis about the name. So if I don't get any feedback, it probably will be my first and last. So let's spice it up.
Do you have anything you want to suggest people start with?
Not at all. Maybe something radical, something political. I don't know. Black Panther-ish.
Mm-hmm. Panther-ish. Yeah. Like that term.
Black womanist?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're expecting big things, listeners. Desiree's reputation in the Twitterverse depends upon this.
Oh, God.
All right. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon with Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Baham III. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are our executive producers and hosts. Our intern and special announcer is Amy Casey. Mitch Scorza is our director and engineer. The Project Censored show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com and visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all of our radio shows for the past 6 years, as well as 40 years of news that didn't make the news. Also, that's where you can find the list of films to watch for our upcoming show on authoritarianism and movies. Looking forward to that. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive force, enslavement for almighty. Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, in the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out the reach, all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the